Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin.
Welcome to the first episode of ObserverCast, the Oklahoma Observer's weekly podcast on Oklahoma politics. The Oklahoma Observer began over a half century ago as a news journal, and in that time, we've brought insight and analysis that only our publication can provide.
But technology evolves, and with it, journalism. We're launching this new format for Observer readers.
And now, listeners.
To better reach you in all the ways you expect in 2020, digitally, in print, and now in a podcast.
The substance of our content will not change, only the selection of the ways that you receive it. For our inaugural episodes, we decided we'd take a thematic approach, focusing on Governor Kevin Stitt and his vision for Oklahoma.
We've noticed since he was campaigning for office and then in his first year as governor, a trend, you might call it, to his agenda during his time on the second floor of the Oklahoma State Capitol.
Granted, it's only been a year since he was inaugurated, but it's been action-packed. Within 6 weeks of his inauguration in 2019, he signed into law not only permitless carry, a bill that Governor Mary Fallon had vetoed, but also legislation revamping five key state agencies and reorganizing their leaders as his direct appointees.
Normally, legislation of this magnitude would be introduced in February, passed back and forth between the Oklahoma House and Senate for nearly 3 months, and then land on his desk near the end of April or early May. But instead, he held his signing ceremony flanked by the hypermajority Republican legislators the first week of March.
This was symbolic, a signal to the state as to the importance of his efforts to, as Governor Stitt put it, look at Oklahoma government with fresh eyes. But the fact is, this wasn't a fresh idea at all. Oklahoma politics has been rife with efforts for nearly a generation at least to give more powers to the governor.
But something is different about this governor and the agility with which he's able to move legislation of this significance through the process. Because last year, it was five agencies with significant state budgets over which he took control.
But after session ended in May 2019, he made more moves. He began overtures to the tribes aimed at renegotiating the gaming compacts. Stitt made promises to unveil a health care plan, even after the initiative petition surpassed the required signatures to be placed on the ballot in 2020. And most recently, he's begun talking about how he wants to consolidate the Turnpike Authority with the Oklahoma Department of Transportation, make the state superintendent of education a gubernatorial appointee, as well as other moves.
So we're making this move to centralize power in the Oklahoma governor's hands, something the founders of our state intentionally wrote out of the state constitution, the theme of ObserverCast through the legislative session this spring.
And we think this is not only a very old idea, but this is not normal.
Not normal at all.
The blueprint to turn Oklahoma's weak governor into a strong chief executive was detailed in 1995's A Government as Good as Our People, report of the Governor's Commission on Government Performance. More accurately, the 69-page report was referred to as the Keating Report, as in then-GOP Governor Frank Keating.
The two major obstacles standing in the way of improving the efficiency and quality of state services, the 29-member Blue Ribbon panel wrote, are a complex, out-of-date constitution and a weak, quote, chief executive officer. Until we change these basics, the report said, other reforms will have little impact on the operation of government.
The Keating Report recommended myriad reforms in state government, ranging from consolidating information technology to reducing the number of statewide elected officials to even having the governor and lieutenant governor run as a team. Many of the proposed changes would have expanded the governor's authority, including power to appoint the state superintendent of public instruction, corporation commission members, and the insurance and labor commissioners.
Unlike most blue ribbon studies, the Keating Report wasn't tossed into history's dustbin. It was kept in the Republican quiver until 2010, when Mary Fallon's election as governor gave the GOP control of the entire legislative process. The first sign that the Keating Report was moving from theory to reality came after a dust-up at the first state Board of Education meeting under then-new Superintendent Janet Barisi in January 2011.
When the board, all appointees of former Democratic Governor Brad Henry, rejected three of Barisi's proposed staff hires, including her campaign manager in the department's number two position, Fallon and Republicans pounced. Lawmakers not only neutered the board, giving all decision-making authority to the superintendent, but also gave the governor the power to replace board members at her discretion, both actions that dovetailed with the Keating Report's push to re-engineer the state's common education structure.
As University of Central Oklahoma political science professor John Wood first noted in a paper presented to the Oklahoma Political Science Association in November 2013, the legislature has frequently helped expand gubernatorial power for Fallon, often mirroring Keating Report proposals. The state's information technology infrastructure was consolidated under control of a newly created chief information officer, selected by the governor. The State Human Services Commission was abolished, and the governor was given the authority to appoint a CEO-like Department of Human Services director.
The state's workers' compensation system was overhauled, shifting from a court to an administrative system controlled by a three-member workers' compensation commission and a nine-member advisory council appointed by the governor. Last year, Governor Stitt persuaded lawmakers to give him authority to hire and fire the directors of five of the state's largest agencies, Transportation, Corrections, Juvenile Affairs, Healthcare Authority, and Mental Health Substance Abuse Services.
And his call to get the power to appoint the state superintendent of public instruction? Also another Keating Report recommendation. It seems pretty clear then that Governor Stitt's plan draws from a deep well with ideas that have been percolating for many years here in Oklahoma. But we wanted to see what key players in the past who experienced this directly had to say. Not only about how this played out in the past, but also how it seems to be playing out now in 2020.
We're shooting for a weekly podcast, and we thought heading just sort of as a theme for the beginning of this thing is to take a look at Stitt's power grab and the dream of the Keating plan come true, I guess, in all this. And the reason that we thought you would be a great one to start with is I'm pretty sure you were the last governor who came straight from the private sector into the mansion. Mm-hmm. And I thought you might have a particularly interesting perspective on sort of what you anticipated, what you found, what frustrated you, what you thought. And now with hindsight and seeing what's happening now, you might be able to help put into perspective for people exactly what's happening and whether these are good things or bad things potentially for the state.
Yeah.
We're talking to former Oklahoma Governor David Walters, who served in that role from 1991 to 1995. Now working in the renewable energy sector and highly involved in national and state Democratic politics, Walters was the first governor after Robert S. Kerr, who had never held elective office before serving as governor. Although he ran and lost the race for governor in 1986 against Henry Bellman, Walters assumed office also with a hypermajority in the legislature. But we wondered, what may have been different during his time? Or was it?
Well, it's kind of like, not to compare Governor Stitt to Donald Trump, but, you know, I now have a list of things. I now have something called the Omnibus Who Knew Act, which was like, who knew you didn't have to file taxes? Who knew you could start a war without anybody's approval? Who knew you could do all these things? You know, who knew you could turn our foreign policy over to Russia? I mean, it's all these. So I call it the Omnibus Who Knew Act, and the next time the Democrats take over, hopefully they'll give them the 500 items on that list now that should be corrected. So I think you have to be, I think this, it doesn't seem to have proceeded very cautiously as the, you know, hypermajority Republican Senate and House agrees with whatever the governor's put out there. So there should be a little bit more caution to understand what are the checks. What if you get a complete crazy person in as governor? How much damage can they do? Well, I don't think they let you start a war. I think there needs to be some check on this. But having said that, the governor has very little direct authority, or in the past, and the cabinet was entirely informal. You know, I don't know who started that. Maybe George and I think maybe David Bourne did. But somebody started just pretending like they had a cabinet. And I think that was David Bourne, where he said, okay, you're going to be in charge of education, but it was all volunteer. Nobody got paid anything. There were no new hires. And then she had to pick an agency head, and they just did double duty, and they kept up with other agencies in their sphere of influence. And so we continued that, but with a little, I think it continued to get more organized. By the time I got there, it really was something where we met together, we strategized together, we really used our cabinet, and we set overall goals, employment goals. We knew we had this huge burden, if you will, hanging over us, in which, thankfully, the Republican governor and a Democratic legislature before me passed $1 billion of expenditure increase for public education, and to their credit, they funded $500 million of it with tax increases, which, when you think about that, in 1991, $500 million in today's dollars, that's a big deal. I mean, a lot bigger than what went on here recently. And so they really stretched the envelope to get that funding put in place, and but it was left to us to find another $500 million without raising taxes. I suppose I could have wandered in there and said, let's raise taxes, but that wasn't going to go anywhere.
Sorry to interrupt. I just realized something, too. The healthcare authority was actually created during your administration,
right,
as a way to spend Medicaid spending by taking it out of DHS.
Yeah, Clinton gave us, he gave us some really great incentives because they allowed us to engage in waivers that allowed us to be a lot more flexible with Medicaid financing, particularly. And so that, it was sort of a golden age right then. I had Garth Splinter, who was a genius, and the guy had an engineering degree, Harvard MBA, and then he became a physician. He was just bored with life, I think. He just kept getting educated. And he designed, for a while, back in the Hillary Care days, Ira Magaziner, who was, remember that guy, the big head of hair, he was in charge of that effort, and somebody made him meet with me and Garth, and he was sort of irritated. He had to, talk to another Clinton buddy who was the governor, and that meeting was supposed to go for 30 minutes. It went on for like 3 hours, and so Garth had convinced them to start exploring medical savings accounts, which is a common thing now, but at the time was very unusual. So we had a great group there in the healthcare authority and starting that.
So I guess the point is, though, is that even then, when you couldn't appoint every state agency, there was still great innovation.
Very,
you could
very
turn it blocks over and find new ideas.
Yeah, but you don't find a David Walters every day. No.
Of course not.
Yeah,
There's only one.
Yeah. only one. No, that's a very good point. That so much of this is involved with good ideas. When I walked into that office, I was just aghast after a month or two how nothing was driven by merit. We'd have a meeting with the legislative leadership, and it was all about this interest and that interest, and oh my God, they'd kill us in this campaign thing. And it was just it was just refreshing every once in a while to have a conversation about what should we do to actually improve the quality of life in Oklahoma. And so if you get somebody that's bold enough and can finesse it enough, I couldn't. I mean, I managed to irritate Gaylord to no end. And, they launched on us from the very beginning and really had us hobbled for a lot. But even hobbled, as you point out, You know, we passed the Quality Jobs Act. We created the Healthcare Authority, taking full advantage of those waivers. And we had at the end of my term, we had a 38% increase in education, public education funding, written up in the Associated Press. But that was because we just were hell bent. I sold the airplane. We let attrition drop the state employment, probably the first time since the run. You know, somebody fired the gun and the employment grew geometrically. I think we have the only dip in state employment during our term, and we needed that to save the money to cover that. So, good point. You can still get a lot done, but it would be less agonizing, I think, if you had a real cabinet, at least a cabinet that had a better line responsibility, so the governor didn't have, 55 reporting relationships and really have more like 8 or 10 that he could delegate through.
Was it a surprise to you that the legislature ceded as much power as it did?
As quickly as they did?
No, not given the status of the GOP these days. I mean, it's as we've moved into this cult-like environment, not that Kevin Stitt's the leader of the cult, but there is demanded and expected, I think, a kind of slavish devotion to party these days that that we sure didn't, I sure didn't have when I was in office. I mean, the Democrats fought me as much as anybody, and were quite irritated with me most of the time, up to and including one time I had the Republican caucus over to the mansion to try to get them as allies to pass the horror of it all. And, oh my God. So I'm not surprised by that, given where we are in the status of our party politics. And Kevin Stitt was a new, young governor that, had a strong, business management background. And so it was easy for the majority party at that point to lay down and say, let's give this guy. I think everybody's understood that the governor's office has been weaker than many.
Weaker than it should have been?
Probably weaker than it should have been. I think, despite it's a very legitimate point that you can still do good things with good ideas and the power of persuasion and, being able to, put one word in front of the other and make your case. But it shouldn't be that hard. I mean, it would be a lot easier if you had a real cabinet structure and if the governor exercised more authority. Now, you'll have to remind me what all they've done, and we can pick that apart. But it seems like he shouldn't be able just to pick the chancellor for higher education. He shouldn't be able to, I liked having I thought the commission at the Department of Human Services, having chaired that at one point many, many years ago when I was a puppy, I thought that was a really kind of effective process for dealing with this hugely complicated entity to have its own board. Now, should it be constitutional? It was then and now it's not. But I can only imagine the difficulties there.
Well, they've essentially made the boards and commissions of, 5 of the largest agencies all but irrelevant.
Yeah.
And so it puts the governor's office, it puts the governor in charge of basically hiring and firing the directors and controlling the direction of each of those agencies, on their own. And I'm guessing there was a reason that the founding fathers set all this up in a way that, set up the boards and commissions that were to be filled, in theory at least, with people who had expertise and who would...
Yeah.
Because this is a governor who hardly bothered to vote, much less appeared to have any great political philosophy or agenda.
Right. Right. Yeah, I don't think there's theoretically, that's exactly right. You should be able to select experts in the arena, have them come together and make really good decisions. Somehow the governor has to exercise enough authority about that. So the fact that he is involved in appointing, what happened here is that the Senate and the House kept growing in terms of their, every time there was a deal cut with the executive branch, they kept carving out more appointments directly. So the Senate and the House began exercising their own executive authority. And somehow that got ceded away over time. And in so doing, the governor really didn't, in many cases, have enough control to really exercise much influence in those agencies. I'll give you a good example. The highway department should be, the highway department, you got all this federal money and state money and gas tax. And so you got these zillion dollars coming into the state. And then we've got a very robust turnpike authority. Well, for me to have any influence on the highway commission, for example, because once those guys are appointed, they're their own little czars in the way that operates. Thank you, Gene Stipe. And, you know, so they set it up quite czar-like. And so for me to have any influence and may rest in peace, Delmas Ford actually came up with this idea. He said, you know, there's nothing that says we've got to have 8 highway commissioners. You know, apparently there's nothing at that time, there wasn't any statutory requirement for it. So we created 9 highway districts and I became a highway commissioner. Nobody knew that really, but I got 1/9 of the money allocated, just like in the past it was allocated in 8s. And so I used those dollars when I had a road or a highway or a project that I thought was important and across the boundaries of these commission districts or what have you, I could match fund their dollars and get something done. It was just, you can't make people do what they don't want to do, but you can incentivize them to do it. You know, they have to want to do it. Oh my God, they're getting 50% of a road built that they get partial credit for, in addition to whatever budget they already had. That's a kind of a complicated example, and I remember when I described that to Frank Keating, he just completely glazed over. So I don't think anybody's done that again.
As Governor Walters just told us, even Oklahoma's historically so-called weak governor can make big changes without consolidating power on the second floor of the state capitol. There are maneuvers you can take within existing gubernatorial powers that can still impact change without throwing the baby and the bathwater out. Also, a fully empowered cabinet could help a governor enact their agenda without placing state agency control directly in the governor's hands. We have to remember, though, that there's a system of checks and balances in our state. There are 2 chambers in the state legislature, in addition to the courts. And Governor Walters told us he wasn't so sure the legislature with a hypermajority, something he had when he was governor, would serve as an effective check on Governor Stitt. Walters made it clear to us that, during his time in office, his fellow Democrats in the legislature had no problem pushing back on him. And this was something former State Senator Cal Hobson repeated when we sat down and talked with him. That when Governor Walters seemed to rebuff the legislature, they felt comfortable returning in kind. We asked Hobson, who served over 30 years in the legislature and as Senate President pro tempore before term limits kicked in, what makes Governor Stitt different. And as you'll hear, he has plenty of points of comparison.
You've seen this for, golly.
1978.
Yeah. Yeah. How's my math there?
42 years.
Yeah. So have you seen efforts like this before to consolidate power in the governor's office? And if so, how was that rolled back and prevented from taking place, and why? What I guess we want to know what this means for Oklahoma potentially.
My experience goes back to when David Boren was leaving as governor, going to the United States Senate, and George Nye was coming in as governor in 78. And of course, Nye had been around forever, and the legislature was 2/3 Democrats. And I don't recall a great hue and cry about reorganizing or consolidating, and he had two terms. And then Henry Bellman returned in 1986, and he had a commission to, you know, revise, as every governor does, a committee of 100 or something with a bunch of new ideas, which are usually not a bunch of new ideas. They're just kind of rehashed. But Governor Bellman had some of that, and it fell flat pretty quick, because I remember one of the first proposals, not directly on reorganization, but it was to abolish the dental school, of all things, in Oklahoma. And when asked why, his budget guy, my good friend Lex Holmes here at the University of Oklahoma, said, well, because kids don't get cavities anymore. And that kind of ended, you know, that discussion. Then came David Walters, and Walters is like Governor Stitt in that both came from the private sector, no elected experience. And you will recall that he had pretty rough days initially with the legislature. One of my colleagues, the best thing he could say about Governor Walters in 1991, after Walters' speech on the South Steps, when Walters dramatically turned around and looked back at us, the legislature all sitting there after his remarks, he said to the 6,000 people freezing out there on the South lawn, Walters turned around, looked at us and said, you know what the problem is in Oklahoma? It's those guys sitting right behind me. So that wasn't...
And this was the same party.
We were the same party. And when we got inside, one of the reporters asked a senior senator what he thought about Walter's speech. And that fella said, well, the best I can say is he's probably trainable. And there that was. Then came Governor Keating for two terms, who also had kind of... visions of more power in the governor's office. He always chafed at it, but he didn't follow through as dramatically and as hard as maybe Governor Stitt thinks he's going to, or has, in effect. So then Henry for two terms, and he was very cooperative with both parties, got a lot done, and now Governor Stitt. So they each have a different kind of way of presenting themselves, but for a fellow who didn't bother to vote for 20 years before he became governor, I'm a little surprised at his degree of confidence about what should and shouldn't be done.
So over the years, did you ever think there really were some things that perhaps some power that should be vested in the governor that wasn't there that might have improved the efficiency of state government? Or do you think the founders got it right when they first set up Oklahoma back in the early 1900s?
Well, that's a great question, and I've been on, believe it or not, two of those mandatory every 20-year groups that looks at the Constitution and decides how to revamp it and then go to the vote of the people and streamline it, shorten it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, those always fizzled out, because you find that people who are embedded in the Constitution with certain protections, and the most recent example was homeschoolers, they will appear when otherwise they never show up at the Capitol and explain to you why they like it the way it is. So I have carried some bills that abolished an agency here or an agency there, but just a complete revamping always falls short, because quite frankly, the way Oklahoma is structured, east versus west, urban versus rural, all those things, tribes versus the state, people really like a complicated system, even though they will complain about it. But when they meet the people they're trying to impact, my friend George and I got me to carry the bill to move the fire marshal office into the OSBI office, Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. Made great sense to me as a freshman until I met all the firemen from throughout Oklahoma who explained to me why they needed their own separate agencies. So that's the reality of trying to do those these things. But I will say, and I'll also shorten my answers, I will say that Governor Stitt got by with things with this very cooperative legislature that no other governor has been able to accomplish for good or ill. And I have a number of reasons why I think they rolled over.
Well, I was going to say, how much of that does have to do with term limits? Because
these are new legislators.
This is the legislative leadership is not as seasoned as it was in your era, for example.
Well, that's certainly part of it. And of course, that's a big part of it. The other is the overriding philosophy of almost every Republican I've ever met that came to the legislature initially says government bad, taxes bad, smaller good. And so when Governor Stitt would make the argument, you know, we need to streamline, we need to consolidate power so we can make quick decisions. I've been given a mandate by the people to do these things. That rings solid until you begin to think about it from a legislative point of view, and I think many of them didn't. They didn't want to cross him early, so they acquiesced an enormous amount for not very much in trade of controlling four or five major agencies. A few legislators, like the budget chief in the Senate, kind of perked up and said, wait a minute. I talked to him the other day, as a matter of fact, and he's very concerned about this new methodology of how agencies display their budgets to legislators. You know, they kind of have to jump through the hoops with the governor's office, the finance folks, before they reveal the real secrets about what they need and want. And some of them are so anxious to please the man on the second floor, they've gone in and said, I think it was the health department, even though we have a number of counties without a health department, I would like to cut my budget. That doesn't strike to me as smart services to the public, but that's kind of the path. So it's those two things, term limits plus a philosophy that quicker, smaller, government is bad, let's go home.
So I would ask, though, this idea of small government, I'd really like to kind of signal boost this notion that what he's doing is actually a power grab. It's not shrinking government in any way, shape, or form. You know, he's brought in a number of out-of-state contractors and vendors to do the role of people that had at once existed, you know, at state agencies. So, I mean, he's not eliminating the need or the services that existed. He's just moving things around in a sense, but it's all his, you know, he's the final say is what I feel like is happening.
We've seen this drilled before. I'll give you a firm example. You may recall that, again, Governor Keating, in his zeal for privatization, decided to abolish these part of the State Department of Transportation that did the maintenance along highways, interstate highways, and he found a firm in Pennsylvania that was going to do it cheaper, better, and faster, and got his appointee to the Department of Transportation, a former legislator by the name of Herschel Crow, to sell the proposal, and you know, in the name of saving money, downsizing, and they tried that for a little while, became very unhappy with the services. The money went back to Pennsylvania that was paid. It didn't stay here, and that quickly faded away. So yes, you're exactly right. It's kind of moving the deck chairs around and designating a new name or a new structure or office in a new building or whatever.
It's easy to look at the past, but we wanted to know what it was like on the ground in the legislature now with Governor Stitt as he moves to consolidate power in the governor's office and tries to enact his agenda. We talked with Minority Leader Representative Emily Virgin, who started her time representing House District 44 when Governor Mary Fallon started her 8 years in office. So Virgin can tell us how it has been done and how the governor's office has operated in the past, but also what makes this governor different.
I've had some pretty different experiences, but being that I came in at the same time as Governor Fallon, I saw her entire administration and saw it change a little bit, but there were some constants. And I think one of the constants was that her office didn't really interact with the legislature a whole lot. And that probably lent itself to some of the dysfunction that we saw, I think, when she was in office. And at the end of her term, I think that was changed a little bit, but she also took a more adversarial tactic with the legislature. You saw her veto several pretty controversial bills. She vetoed the permitless carry bill that was passed before, the one that Governor Stitt signed. So, you know, she was an interesting, in looking back at things, she's a really interesting case study, I think, the way that she changed in the course of the 8 years that she was in office. Because she did enact some pretty conservative tax policy following the Kansas model, and but then reversed some of that and realized, I think, the error of her ways in cutting funding for things. And so she left office with a budget surplus, and she left with, you know, a teacher pay raise, and she left after cutting legislator salaries. And so that was sort of part of the adversarial relationship, I think, that she had with the legislature was, you know, her appointees on the Legislative Compensation Board, she was pushing them to cut our salaries. And so they did that. The most recent Legislative Compensation Board meeting, they decided to increase our salaries. So, you know, I think legislators like Governor Stitt a little more because he was sort of instrumental in making that happen. And it's not something that's popular to talk about, but, you know, you do want your legislators to be paid well enough so that regular folks can afford to do it. Then Governor Stitt has come in, and I think at the beginning of his administration, he did reach out to legislators across the aisle, and I think every House Democrat and I assume every Senate Democrat went to breakfast at the governor's mansion and sort of just had a getting to know you sort of breakfast event. And that was pretty early on in his term. And we appreciated that. And I think it's important for us to have those personal relationships because that helps when you're thinking about crafting legislation, but also it helps with sort of the tone and the civil discourse when you actually know the people that you're working with and the people that you are potentially talking bad about. I think it really helps us be more productive. So I was encouraged by that. And then there really wasn't a whole lot after that. So I think he came in with good intentions and then, of course, probably got busy with the things that you have to do as governor. But what we've seen is that he has sort of realized, and I think this is what happens when you have someone who comes in as a total outsider and somebody who I think he would admit hasn't been involved in state government at all really before this. And some people might think that's good. Some people might think that's bad. You can have whatever opinion you want on that. But I think that he came in and was surprised by a lot of things. And now he's trying to change those things because he thinks that that's not the way that they should be. So you're seeing a lot of him bringing this private CEO mentality to state government and to the governor's office, because I think as someone who was running a company, he was able to make big changes unilaterally. And I think he's been frustrated that he hasn't been able to do that by himself. But that's sort of the way that government is supposed to work. Of course, the governor is elected by the voters of the state, but the reason why you want more voices involved is because there are other elected officials who are closer to the people. So the House of Representatives, because we run every 2 years, we have the smallest district, we're the ones who are probably most in tune with what the citizens want, at least from our legislative districts. And it's important to have that voice in there, but also balanced out by the Senate, who's not up for reelection all the time. So they can be a little bit more deliberative. And then the governor, who sort of is the executive, but is probably the furthest away from the actual citizens and voters and what they're thinking and feeling, because the governor is just one person and they represent 3 million people, 4 million people, whatever it is now. And so it's a balance that works well for us, because you have people who are electeds who are really close to the people, and you have electeds who are a little bit farther away and can take a 10,000 foot view rather than our 1,000 foot view. And so that's a good balance, but also because, you know, it should be hard to change things in government, because you don't want things going back and forth all the time. You want some consistency, because people who depend on government services need consistency. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part of why state government, I think, should be pretty hard to change things in state government, because we have a lot of people who depend upon what we do as a state and those services that we provide. And they need to know that those services are going to be there and have a little bit of consistency when it comes to the physical location of things, mm-hmm. and the people that they talk to and the policies that are in place. Because if you're applying for something every month or every year, it gets really confusing if it changes every single time. And of course, we do have some things that change a lot and it causes difficulties. And I think that's why as House members, it's so important for us to listen to our constituents, because we're the ones who are most likely to hear those things about, it's really hard for me to apply for whatever it is, or it's really hard for me to find the right office for XYZ. I think also it's important for us to recognize the history of our state, mm-hmm. and that Oklahoma is one of those, it is a pretty unique case in that our government from the beginning has been a very populist form of government. And that was the way that things started for us. And I think that it's important, just like you hear people at the national level always talk about the founders and mm-hmm. their intent with the Constitution, it's important for us to recognize the founders of Oklahoma and their intent with our Constitution and the way that they set up our government. And of course, you can debate whether that's good or not, but the reason why they did that was so that a lot of power wouldn't be vested in one single person.
I think the takeaway from our discussions with Governor Walter, Senator Hobson, and Representative Virgin show us that there is a long history of a sometimes combative or adversarial relationship between the legislature and the governor's office. As Democrats, we often hear when throwing barbs at Republicans' policies, they say, well, the Democrats did it too. But it doesn't seem that in the past, hypermajority control of our state government led to the House and Senate laying down to the governor. In fact, it wasn't smooth sailing at all. And maybe we're just oppositional in nature as Democrats. At the end of the day, though, here at ObserverCast, we think we just keep a laser focus on workaday Oklahomans. You know, the people who send the governor and the legislators to office in the first place. Most importantly, the residents of our state are the ones impacted for real, in real life, by government changes. Their lives are not abstract ideas, but his changes can have real, concrete effects, and too many Oklahomans' lives are already overly complicated. It doesn't seem like Governor Sitt's big ideas and fresh eyes have considered yet the practical effects of his changes. And if you don't understand the core functions of government, how could you understand the practical impacts of your choices as governor? Really, Senator Hobson said it best.
The reality is that you couldn't be overserved in Oklahoma in a number of areas like education and healthcare and infrastructure and if you have too much services for the people. We have all those terrible indicators that should worry any governor, regardless of his philosophy about big government, little government. It's what ends up serving the people. And my argument is we clearly are not adequately doing that today.
We'd like to thank our listeners for downloading our inaugural podcast today. Look for the next episode to drop next Monday, February the 24th, where we'll talk about Senate Bill 1780, Senate President Pro Tem Greg Treat's legislation to sunset the Merit Protection Commission.
If you're interested in sponsoring our work here to keep ObserverCast going, please contact us at 405-478-8700 or email Arnold at ahamilton@okobserver.org. That's A-H-A-M-I-L-T-O-N at O-K-O-B-S-E-R-V-E-R.org. Know you'll be reaching a highly engaged, information-hungry audience through your sponsorship. Please subscribe to our podcast as well, share on social media if you like what you hear, and help us keep the proverbial lights on here for our podcast.
We also want to thank Governor David Walters, former State Senator Cal Hobson, and Minority Leader Representative Emily Virgin for sitting down with us and lending their insight to us. Also, thanks to the Pioneer Library System and the good folks who helped us out at the Makers Lab at the sparkling new Norman Central Library, where portions of this episode were recorded.
And finally, the music you're hearing is by Oklahoma artist Jared Duck, a fellow resident of Norman. His latest album, Bully Pulpit, is available for purchase, and he's playing at Hollywood Corners in March. Learn more at jareddeckmusic.com. ObserverCast is powered by the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, striving to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. To support the foundation, please visit okobserver.org and click on the donate button. Also, we'd like to offer a special $1.99 a month digital subscription to the Observer itself for those who sign up and subscribe to our podcast. That's 60% off the regular one-year digital-only cost of $40. The $1.99 per month cost will go up to $3.99 after the first year, which is still a low, low rate for the high-quality content that only the Observer can provide. Thank you for joining us this week for the first episode of ObserverCast.